everybody, I'm Julie, and I am an alcoholic. And what she means by being a rescue is that Liz was supposed to be telling her story tonight, but she's just today tested negative for COVID and did not feel like she would be able to stand up here for 40 minutes and tell her story. And you may be wondering why I was the number one choice for her backup. And some of you may know that, most of you probably in this room do not know that Liz is my sister, my blood sister, my real sister. And I'm sorry that you're not going to be hearing her story tonight because it is really a wonderful story, and she's an incredible member of Alcoholics Anonymous with 11 years sobriety. And you know, even though we share a whole lot of DNA, we couldn't be more different. and we both like the beach. But other than that, we really are two completely different people. And so I will do my best after an hour so that you guys don't feel ripped off at the end. But I will start off with this one because it is a little funny to me. And it sort of leads into my story. Just a little bit. I'm not going to make it fast. So I am the last of five children. My sister Nan is 8 years older than me. My sister Liz, who you are not listening to right now, is 7 years older than me. My sister Nina is 4 years older than me. My brother is 2 years older than me, and I am the baby. And my sister Liz is an amazing woman, and she has this talent that, you know, I've always found remarkable, and that is she has a way of getting you to do or give her everything she wants, when she wants it, how she wants it, and make you feel like she's done you a favor after you've done it, right? So I want to tell this story for as long as I can remember. So there's the eight and seven year gap between my older sisters and the three younger ones. So when we were little, my parents would go out to dinner, and my sister Liz and Nan would be babysitting us, right? So when I was like 3 or 4 or 5, this is like 10, 11, 12. And she did this thing one time that I will never forget because it was so fun. she said, okay, to the three youngest ones, come over here. I'm a scientist, and you are my robot, and I'm going to wind you up, and then you have to do everything I tell you to do. Now, when you're 3, 4, 5 years old, this is really fun, right? She does that. She's coming over, her winding me up in the back. And I'm a robot, you know. And she says, okay, go over there and get that laundry and take it upstairs. And we do it. And we're like, not going to help her. It's the best thing ever. Under the stairs, her mother said, the last thing our mother said to her as she walked out the door was, Liz, take the laundry upstairs. So we did it, right? So I just have to, that just sort of sums up my relationship with my sister. And it's a bit ironic that 60 years later, I'm standing here doing her job again. but in reality, no, she really, really did want to be here with you guys, and I am stepping in for her. So again, I do hope that you won't be disappointed. So let me start by saying, I'll do all the math, so I'm benevolent that way, so you don't have to figure all this out. I was born on May 23rd, 1961, which makes me 63 years old. I had my first drink in October of 1979 as a freshman at the University of Florida. I was 18 years old, legal at the time to drink. My sobriety date is February 25th, 1995. So I drank for about 15 years, and in February, if I don't die and I don't drink, I will have 30 years of sobriety. Which is mind-blowing. But I give you all that to let you know that this program, this place, is extraordinarily important to me. And I might even get a little emotional about it because 30 years is a lifetime. And I have lived my life in this program. And living has taken me through the seasons of my life, right? I was a newlywed when I got sober. And I have two children, both neither one of them have ever seen me drunk. My daughter will be 28 in January. My son is 26, and he just lives over here in Brookhaven. My daughter's from Louisville. And my daughter took some of her first steps in that room over there, y'all. So this place means a lot to me. my whole life has been given to me because of Alcoholics Anonymous. Two people on this planet because of Alcoholics Anonymous. Because I guarantee you, while I was drinking, the thought of having bringing a child into this world was not going to happen. So let me start by telling you how I got all that, how I came to be where I am. So I said I had my first drink at the University of Florida. I grew up in Memphis, Tennessee, big family. My parents, my mother died of this disease, all over our family. My father, I would say, was an alcoholic, but probably he could stop. He had iron will, so he could stop when he wanted to. But, you know, we started back up again. So I would guess that he was an alcoholic as well. My sister Liz is an alcoholic. I'm not going to tell anybody else who else in my family is an alcoholic, but at least one other sister probably could be here. And it's just the way I was raised. So I was morally opposed to alcohol because I was watching what it was doing to my mother. And I did not want to be my mother. I was not going to be my mother. I was no fun in high school at all. And I was just a real round-tight little bitch, to be honest with you. And I got to the University of Florida, and I remember my friend Anne Marie was coming over. We were going to go to the fraternity parties, and she showed up with some vodka and orange juice. And I remember where I was, putting on makeup at my makeup mirror, and she made me a screwdriver, and I took one sip, and I instantly changed. I felt this glow, I didn't know how wild tight I was until I wasn't wild tight anymore. Right? I had no idea. And by 30 minutes later, there are pictures of me, and I'm already got that shitty grin on my face. And my friend Amber is looking at me in this picture. I was in the picture. And she's looking at me like, who is this? It's like she let the genie out of the bottle or something, you know? And I drank alcoholic tea that night, and I drank alcoholic tea every time if I could. But, you know, I believe that it's hereditary. I believe that it's a part of my makeup because I was morally opposed to it. I had one sip of it, and now it's my best friend. So I don't think you can go from that place to that place without having had a physical reaction in your body to something, which is what I believe happened to me. So I drank. I did well in college. I was active in college. I graduated from college, and I became a single young woman in Tampa with all my single young friends. And we had a really, really good time. And my friends, I was telling myself, were drinking just like I was. Because they were drinking, right? Therefore, they were drinking like I was. But it was pretty clear that, you know, they could go home or they could get a date and not just last call. I mean, last call is the bar, and that's two things to me, y'all. I'm sorry, but it did. And last call's not a lot of seconds left, I can tell you. But they would like, we were all doing okay with our careers and everything, but they would like starting to get engaged, starting to get long-term boyfriends, starting to get promotions, just things that I really wasn't particularly doing. And then I started living by myself, and I started drinking every night by myself. And I just couldn't wait to get home from work to drink by myself. Or if I was out with them, to drink with them as well. But I was drinking and driving and doing all the things you shouldn't do. I drank to a state of pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. You know, I do not know why I'm here. I do not know why I did not kill myself or somebody else in my car. One night I picked up a guy and we went to dinner. And I'm pretty damn sure I paid too. And we were so drunk. And this place was a pizza place in downtown Tampa that was upstairs. And you had to walk up this big, long stairway of wooden steps. And in leaving, I turned around to say something to him and started to fall down the steps backwards. Grabbed him. We both fell all the way down the wooden steps. All the way down. And I believe I am alive because I was drunk. Because that hurts. It's not like the movies. It is not like the movies. That really hurt. But I did not die, and he did not. Thankfully. But I did what we do. My girlfriends were not there to see that. The next morning, I call him all up.
the funniest thing happened. It was so funny. You know, my soul needed to think it was funny, because my soul knew it wasn't. And alcoholism wanted my soul to know it was funny. Alcoholism was so sinless. Remember the PR spin the next day, how it was all so much fun? But it wasn't. And none of my friends laughed. I remember none of them laughed at that. I then moved to Dallas for a job, for my job. And that's when I really hit bottom. I had a lot of things going on at that time. A guy that I was dating, he died of a heart attack at like 33 years old, I mean, or 36 years old. I ended up with this really horrible boss. I mean, this was a really bad time. Plus, I was drinking massive doses of alcohol every night. And that combination led me to really be almost a basket case, to be honest with you. But I ended up needing to come home. I had to quit my job. I was 29 years old, and I moved back here to Atlanta, where my parents live, and moved in with my parents at 29 years old. And I couldn't, I just was so demoralized. I didn't know what was going on, you know. But I was just every night drinking with my parents. I mean, you know, like your parents that have a little TV tray in front of the TV and they're watching Wheel of Fortune and Jeopardy, and you're like sitting there with them at 30 years old because, like, they're drinking, so you're going to drink their alcohol too, right? That went on for longer than I want to admit. But I began to kind of come out of it a little bit. I always was clinically depressed. There was a great deal of depression going on. But I was drinking massive doses of a depressant every night. So that kind of helps. I eventually sort of got a job and ended up, I don't like the order of the story anymore. Like I said, I had a lot of encounters. I didn't have a lot of dates. My sister Liz and I, because she comes again in the story, she and I drank here in Atlanta a lot, and we played a lot of bocce ball at Aunt Charlie's. If you're old enough to know what Aunt Charlie's was, we drank a lot all along Far Road with all those people in the early 90s. But then one day I ran into a man who I had gone to college with, and it had been 10 years since we'd been in college. And lo and behold, he asked me out. And weirdly, he didn't leave like the rest of them did. I don't know. You'd have to ask him what his issues are. Because I think there's some issues there. But he didn't leave. And he still hasn't left. And we have been married 31 years now. We've been together 34 years, 33 and a half years. And I put him through the ringer. But I know what long-term commitment means, and I know what it means because of this program. And like I said, we ended up having two children together. But what happened, better hurry up and get sober. So we started dating. I was drinking alcoholically. He drank with me, but, you know, again, my alcoholism is telling me that he's drinking as much as I am, but he's not. We move in together. I'm getting kind of old, y'all. I didn't get married until I was 33 years old, you know. That's kind of old. And, back then. And compared to, like, everybody else in my life. We get engaged. I'm still drinking. We get married. I'm still drinking. And I can tell you guys, alcohol will ruin an event whether you're drinking it or not when you're in active alcoholism, right? The book tells us that we are restless, irritable, and discontented between drinks. So on my wedding day, bright thing that I am, I say I cannot drink until reception. His wedding was like at 6:30 or whatever, reception 7:30, I don't remember. But my maid of honor shows up with a bottle of wine. I'm like, no, can't have it. And by the time I got finished being married at the altar, I was so distracted. I didn't pay attention. I sometimes wonder if I'm legally married. I was so distracted. I'm like, I wasn't even there. All I could think about was, when will this be over so I can get a drink at the reception? Ruins my wedding. And I would like to do it again. But,
It's sad and it's true though, and that's what alcohol will do. Even when you're not drinking it, it's going to ruin it for you. So, I'm married. We are building a house. I have a job. I have a car, and I am drinking myself to blackout every single night. You know, there's nothing wrong with my life, but I have the disease of alcoholism. And once I took that first drink in October 1979. I was guaranteed to continue to do that until something happened to change that. And so what happened? I was 11 months married, so it was a newlywed. And I was seeing a psychiatrist because I was depressed, because I was drinking massive doses of a depressant every night. And every morning was the same. Have you guys ever seen the movie When a Man Loves a Woman? Okay, there's that scene when he brings her, like, coffee every single morning, and it's cold when by the time she gets out of bed. Oh, my God, I lived that. My husband would bring me a cup of tea every single morning, and it would be cold by the time I got out of bed. And so one morning I was hungover as hell, moaning, groaning. How many times can you get the flu in 1 week, right? And I remember I was on my side, and I had the pillow on my head, and I was looking into our walk-in closet in our little apartment right around here somewhere, and my husband was ready to go to work. I wasn't even out of bed. And I'm kind of moaning. And he looks at me from the closet. I see him. And he says something he's never done before. He said, "For God's sake, get out of the bed!" And grabs his jacket off the hanger. I could see him the hanger go like this and leaves. And I was just like, and I don't know, either I said it out loud or I said to myself, "Oh, my God, God, help me." And that afternoon, I happened to have an appointment with my psychiatrist. And I went to her, and I told her, "I'm pretty sure I'm an alcoholic." And she said, in the sweetest voice, "Well, you'd like to get some help for that, wouldn't you?" I burst into tears and said, "I don't know." In my head, my alcoholism was screaming, "You said that out loud? Oh, my God, you can't take that back. Why did you do that?" You know, I'm just wanting to pull the words back. Like, oh, my God, it's out there. Why did I say that out loud? So she was lovely, and she said, "I don't really know that much about it." I think she gave me a copy of The Courage to Change, which is a book about a bunch of famous people who got sober. And she said, "Come back next week. My colleagues know more about this, and I will get some information for you." So I came back the next week. And she told me about a treatment center that's here in Atlanta. And she said, you should go check this place out. So I didn't know what the hell I was doing, y'all. I didn't know what journey I was about to go on, right? I thought my doctor was helping me figure this out. I didn't know anything what a treatment center was or anything like that. I assumed that. And it happened to be near where I worked. And so at lunch, I go to this, and I walk in, and I'm talking to the intake person there, and she's asking me all the questions, and I'm answering them, and I must have got a good score, because she says, "Well, I do think that we can help you here." And I said, because again, I don't know what this is. I thought treatment was like a spa with doctors. You know, it's just like a place where you go and they'll teach you and tell you about alcohol and there'll be a pool and it'll be fun. And, you know, I don't even know what I was doing. And I'm like, okay, well, I'm going to have to take time off work and I have to do this party for this executive on the 24th of February, which is a Friday. So I'll be here February 25th. And she just goes, "Okay." And I'm like, "Don't you have to write that down?" She goes, "No." I noticed I tried to make a reservation at a treatment center. I thought it was a spot. I thought it was like a hotel, right? And a ridiculously determined person. Ridiculously determined. And so, again, I just thought I was going for information. No idea what this journey was going to be. So I did the executive party on February 24th in Smyrna. Got incredibly drunk in Smyrna, drove all the way back to my Briarcliff Road apartment with one eye closed on the entire top end perimeter on February 24th, knowing I was checking into a treatment center the next day. So you tell me God wasn't looking out for me, because that night I should have killed somebody for sure. And I did not. And I showed up at the church on my allotted time. And it was an amazing experience. I walk in, they immediately close and lock the door behind me. They take my razor, my shampoo, my perfume, my shoelaces. I'm like, what the hell? Why is this? I've never done this before. And eventually I really got to the point where I understood what was happening, that I wasn't going to be coming out, and that there was a certain amount of time that I was going to need to be watched and, you know, detoxed and all these things. And so they gave me a big book, a soft cover big book. I always talk about that one, but it's a pretty expensive place for a soft cover big book. But they gave me this big book. Again, I'm like, okay, thank you. I'm like, it's dreary, freaked out, and starting to detox a little bit. And on about the third day, and so we started going to meetings in there, and there's a whole talk about dopamine and serotonin and all that stuff that I couldn't tell you about now. If you, I don't know which one does what to you. I just know we all have it, and some of it's good, and some of it's bad, and some of it's triggered by alcohol, mimics alcohol, and all this stuff. But they also told me a piece of information that I desperately needed. My intellectual self, my prideful self, my shame-based self. They said, you're not a bad person. You're a sick person. You have a disease. And you're always going to have it. And I was like, what? I'm not just weak-willed and stupid compared to everybody else? And this isn't just something that what? It's actually something I can't do anything about. I'm like, yeah, you can't do anything about it. You have alcoholism. You're always going to have alcoholism. But you can put it into remission in a way by following some simple steps, right? So about the third day I was locked in there, I started reading that big book, and I got to the third step prayer, and I got to that sentence where it says, relieve me of the bondage of myself. And as I read that, I had this, like, unbelievable feeling come over me, just this warm, like, oh, everything is going to be all right. And it was a few years into sobriety before I realized I'd only had that sensation one other time. And that was when my friend Anne-Marie Garrity brought that vodka into my dorm room, and I had that first sip of alcohol. It was the exact same feeling. I'm going to be okay. The difference is, the solution to that problem of alcoholism has never turned on me, has never made me act out the way I used to act out. I'm not perfect, but it, and I'm certainly not perfect. We're not saints. But I have not had enough to drink of alcohol since the moment I walked into that treatment center. It just clicked with me in that very moment. It doesn't click with everybody right away, you guys. It doesn't have to. That's why, you know, I feel that the most courageous people in an AA room are the people who have come back after a relapse. Because, you know, the joy of seeing someone come back here who didn't get killed on the way back in, and didn't kill somebody else on the way back in, always fills me with joy. I don't know why I got it that like that, but I did. And I hung on to it because it is extraordinarily precious to me. And I will never forget that feeling, a feeling that everything was going to be okay. And then eventually I did get out of the lockdown part, and I went to the evening program there for I don't even remember how many months. And they said, go to meetings. So my first AA meeting out of treatment was the 9:30 meeting on a Saturday in the small room. And they were so lovely, and, you know, I didn't know. I was just so blind to what was happening. But I really loved that group. But I was working at the time, so I started going to the 5:45. Which is a great meeting if you work during the day and don't want to repeat the habit, like I had, of simply leaving work and going directly to Greens, and even though you tell yourself you're not going to go to Greens, and going to Greens anyway, because somehow the car just seems to go to Greens, and then go home and get drunk every night. So the 5:45 is a great way to break that habit, right? So I started coming to that pretty much every night. And we used to break in the 5:45, we'd close off that room. So some of us would be in the small area, and other people would be in this big area. And I'm looking at my beautiful friend Isla over there, who was there at that time, so she can tell you whether I'm lying or not. But I remember feeling pretty good about myself. for all the stuff I was doing to get sober, right? And I was also proud of myself. And I remember, gosh, the stuff that I would say in meetings back then, they just loved me. Oh, my gosh, they just loved me. And they wanted to kill me, too, I'm sure. But because I just knew everything. I was smart-ass. And so I remember sitting there, and I was sitting at that table, which has the steps in front of it. The curtain was closed. And I was going on and on and on, pontificating about how fabulous I am, that I got myself sober, and I checked into a treatment center, and I told my psychiatrist that I was an alcoholic, and I did this, and I did the meetings, and da-da-da-da. And I looked up at the wall, and then step two just jumped out at me, you know, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. And I went, oh, don't you remember, Julie, that right after John yelled at you that morning, you said in your head, God help me. And then that afternoon you told your psychiatrist that you were an alcoholic, and then this ball started rolling. And I realized right there, I thought I had done the step two, because I was already on step three, because I'd read the third step prayer, right? But it dawned on me in that meeting, as I was so proud of myself, that I hadn't done anything to get sober, that I had called out to a God I didn't even believe in. And the ball started rolling, right? So for me, the best way for me to sum up step two for you, in the way I sum it up, if you have a hard time understanding what it really means, to me, it just means giving credit where credit is due. Period. Right? Came to believe the power greater than myself could assure me sin. The credit goes to my higher power, not me. And to believe that, then I can keep moving. So, I started the journey of sobriety, and with the help of many people in this room, and I was sort of a newlywed by then. My third step, you know, I didn't really understand that third step. It was a little esoteric for me, and a little out there, and your life, and your will, and your thoughts, and your prayers, and your whatever it is, you know. I was like, this is so complicated. My God, what are they actually asking me to do? And so one day, my husband had some friends from college coming up, people I did not really like, and fraternity brothers of his, and we're in our 30s, right? So it's like, fraternity brothers, hey. And they wanted to go whitewater rafting, so we go up to the Chattooga to go whitewater rafting. I drive my little Honda Accord, them and another couple and some other people. I mean, this had two comments. But we go down the river, we come back, we go into the separate men's dressing rooms, change our clothes, and in between there and getting back to the car, I lose the car keys. We're in the Nantahala Wilderness Refuge, right? If you don't know where that is, that's where Eric Rudolph hid from the FBI for 5 years, right? So it's really remote. And I'm like freaking out, because I'm like 3 months sober. I don't like these people. All they want to do is get back in the car and get the hell to Atlanta so they can go to Blind Willie's and get drunk. I feel like an idiot. I'm scared. This is pre-cell phones. So I'm going in and out of the little hut where the guys live all summer, using their phone to try to call AAA, explain AAA where I am. It goes on and on and on and on. And eventually, I'm in there one more time, and I'm talking to the little man in AAA, and I'm trying to be kind, but I'm getting angry and scared. And I hang the phone, and I'm like, this. And there was a guy just behind me, and he says, how's it going? And I said, I don't know. I keep saying the surrendering prayer, and it doesn't seem to be working. And he said, my friend Bill says if you say it enough, it'll work. And I was like, it was like God just beamed him down into that room, and I'm like, oh, thank you. And he asked me how much time I had about 3 months. He goes, you're doing pretty well for 3 months, you know? So if you don't understand what a third step prayer is, it explains it in the 12 and 12, in the last two paragraphs. There's a lot of words before it in the 12 and 12, and a lot of words in the big book, and in the 12 and 12, the last two paragraphs, it says, when I'm disturbed, I pause, and I say the surrounding prayer, or a prayer of any kind. So if you don't think you're doing the third step, ask yourself, today, did I just kind of call out to my higher power, like, oh, help me God, please God, don't let me say this, don't let me say that? If you did, you did a third step. Now, you may not think you did, but you did. And the point of it is that we just keep practicing that until, for me, I had to keep practicing that, and I use the third step a lot because I'm a human being. And you get to the point where the hardest part in early sobriety is recognizing when I'm disturbed. And to get to that point where I'm disturbed, because I liked being disturbed. It was always somebody else's fault, you know. But once I got into the realization that feeling disturbed was too uncomfortable, that's when I began to insert my higher power immediately. And I'm telling you, it will work. It works every time for me. I waited a year to do my fourth step. And there's a lot of BS reasons for why I didn't do it. And many of them I truly believe. One of them I told this poor 545 meeting, Miss Isla, that I could not do a fourth step because I couldn't make columns in Microsoft Word. And I still can't make columns in Microsoft Word. But after hearing that for the last time, you know, I think I was just a little scared to look at myself, you know. But I also was such an A student kind of person that I did not want to go a whole year without having done a fourth step because I thought I would be like a bad AA if I didn't do it. So I finally did it. And there was a man named Donald Siegel, I remember, he said to me, Julie, just get on a piece of paper and at the top of it write, God help me. And then just start writing. Forget the columns, forget it. And I'm like, okay, thank you. And that got me started. So I did it. I had a sponsor that I had gotten, I met her in the treatment center when she'd come out to one of the evening meetings. I'll tell the story real quick. Right after we got, the first time I went out to dinner after I got sober, after I got out of the treatment center, my husband and I had been sober maybe, I don't know, 2 weeks or something. We go up to the Chili's at Soco Hill. I used to love it if there was a wait in a restaurant because we could go to the bar and drink, right? So we walk in and the hostess says, oh, two? That'll be about 5 minutes. And I mean, that bar is just right there. And I'm like, and so we turn around, we sit down on that little wooden bench, looks like the principal's bench outside the school, you know, you're in front of everybody, and they're just walking past you. And we're sitting there, and I start crying. And my husband turns to me, and he's like, do we leave? I'm like, no, I've got to go to the restaurant, you know. And the waitress, the hostess is looking at me like, Jesus, it's only 5 minutes. You don't cry about it. I'm crying, it was 5 minutes. Anyway, we stayed, and I didn't drink. And that's the kind of, I told a story at a meeting, and that's the night my sponsor, I found my sponsor, she said, well, no wonder you've lost your best friend. And I realized it. I didn't realize the relationship that I had built with this thing. So anyway, I had the sponsor, I did my fourth step. Many of you know it was a fearless and searching and fearless moral inventory of everybody else in my life but me, after an entire year of being in AA. I just didn't know how self-blind I was. I didn't know these things about myself. I just thought everybody else was the problem, and I was a perpetual victim. And so my fifth step went like this. I went to her house, and for a few hours I went, well, that bitch this, that asshole this, and this, and blah, blah, blah. And, she listened, and at the very end of it, she gave me the absolute best piece of information I ever got in AA. Still, 30 years later, she smiled very sweetly, and she said, my, what a sad, angry, lonely little girl you are. To me. Julie McKenna, do you know who you were talking to? And I was like, and then I realized, damn, she's right. She's absolutely right. I can't go on like this. I got to be responsible for my behavior and my thoughts and my feelings. No, I just did not realize how much I loved that victimhood, man. I just didn't know it. But, as our friend Rusty says, the steps are in this order for a reason. 6 and 7 come along right after 5, right? So now I've got this information about myself, being a sad, lonely, angry little girl, and opportunities to see that all over the place after that. My husband has a great sense of humor, and he showed me myself everywhere. I mean, just everywhere. And he still shows me myself everywhere because I'm a human and I have character defects that don't always go away. And I think I love 6 and 7 the best because if I stay there, if I'm willing to look at myself and willing to get beyond that kind of behavior, I can become the more spiritual person that I'm supposed to be. It says in our literature, we hear it every single time we read it, the point is we are willing to grow along spiritual lines. That's the whole kit and caboodle for AA. being willing to grow on spiritual lines. I am not going to succeed. I might stay dry, and I might not drink for a while, but I'm not going to have anything that anybody wants, I can tell you that. I'm not going to have anything I want, and I'm going to be a miserable person. And so I have learned to grow along spiritual lines. That does not mean that I am perfect in any by any means. Some of my biggest mistakes were made in sobriety. I've made some doozies that I'm not proud of. I've taken myself into the dark and stayed there a little longer than I wanted to, and but I figured out how to get back into the light, and that's what we do here, and we help each other do that. And so, 6 and 7, I have so many examples of how God showed me, and but I'm not going to go into them. I could go for hours with them. It's a very powerful thing to go through, and I tell my sponsees that if you love your victimhood, do not take a 6 and 7 step, because you can't be a victim and do those steps at the same time. You just can't be. So it came time for making amends, writing a list, and I wrote the list, and my sponsor helped me sort it all out. I started making amends. I've made face-to-face amends with my parents. I will say that I did owe my parents some money, because when you show back up at home at 29, and they like to help you out of credit card debt, and they let you stay in your house for free, and they actually buy your alcohol and all that. You know, you probably do owe them a little bit of money. And I didn't really know how much it was, but I guessed at a number. And when I took it to them, you know, my father said, oh, you know, we're just so happy that you're doing better. Don't worry about it. I think my mom was a little pissed. I wish she wanted money back. But I need to backtrack and tell you this to just give you an idea of how alcoholic my family was. On that Saturday morning that I was checking myself into the treatment center, my husband was getting his MBA at GSU, so he had left for the day. And I get on the phone. Something told me, even though I was like 30-something years old, something told me I should call my parents and tell them where I'm going. I mean, I should tell them I'm checking into basically a hospital, right? So I called them, and I remember shaking so bad on the phone. I'm like, Dad, he goes, yeah, I go, I just want you to know I'm about to check into the alcohol rehab center. He's like, what? Honey? I didn't even know there was a problem. That's how alcoholic my family was. That I wasn't even a problem. Right? We drank so much, y'all, at dinner table. I mean, we didn't believe, but we sure cried afterwards, I can tell you that, and it was tough. But that's how, anyway, I go, so here I am making the most of my parents. So, I think, one of the reasons I was scared to get sober was that I was going to be breaking the paradigm of my family again. Because when I was not drinking, when I was really wound tight in high school and hated alcohol, I wasn't very close with my family or my mother. She didn't want, I mean, alcoholic parents don't want the Cary Nation of the high school in their house all the time, you know? Look up Cary Nation, y'all. Internet, you can get it. So when I started drinking, my mother welcomed me again. It was like I was just like a daughter again, and I was part of the family. And I drank for 15 years, and then I didn't. And then I was kind of feeling like I was going to be the, you know, fry again. And I kind of was. But it wasn't fun, but it was worth it. It was absolutely worth it. And I began to grow. I was already married, but we started having our children. Like I said, my daughter took some of her first steps in this building. And I began to do all those things that I was told to do in this program. I've done, like I said, in terms of amends, face-to-face amends. I wrote a letter to someone because I really needed to apologize to that person, and it worked out beautifully. I now have a relationship with that person again who didn't talk to me for like 10 years. It's hard to find our part, to see our part. It really is, and that's why we need sponsors and people to help us. You know, we're so good at justifying all sorts of errant crap, you know, really. Our ego and our fears and our childhood trauma and all that stuff, it really can help us justify all kinds of stuff. And we have to have somebody help us sort it out and tease it out and see what our part really is. And a lot of times I'll tell my sponsees if they're having a hard time figuring out what their part is in something, I will say, what happened right before your sister stopped talking to you for 10 years? The handcuffs went on.
you got fired again.
What happened right before?
You know? And it works. It really does, because then we think, oh, yeah, it wouldn't just like she just stopped talking to me for 10 years, you know. I did like make out with her husband. I did not do that. I'm just an example. I did not do that. I don't think. But the tenth step is in use all the time because, you know, human beings do human things, and there was a man in the Zoom calls, the Zoom meetings that I was going to during the pandemic. He since passed on, and he was very wise, and he was blind, and so his Zoom name was Blind Jim. He called himself Blind Jim. And he summed up Step 10 really well for us. He said that the principles behind Step 10 are stop and dump. So stop talking or doing whatever it is you're doing that's, you know, not the most right thing. And don't do anything that you know is not the most right thing. And, you know, again, our ego, our fears, everything, we can really talk for ourselves into what the next right thing is, y'all. We need each other. We need to be honest with each other. We need to say, I'm about to do X. Or I just did Y. And listen to what the people in this room have to say to us. I did not start really dedicating myself to meditation until probably 2.5 years ago. I'm no good at it, but started doing it. Got one of those, you know, Meditation for Dummies apps on my phone, and you know what? That's my speed, and I'm okay with that. And I'm probably never going to get to a, you know, blank mind state or whatever. But I now can meditate. I now know the benefits of it and how it calms me down and puts things in perspective. And I highly recommend trying doing that. If you know, just find one of those apps on your phone. And just try it, even for a minute. It really will work. And in terms of the 12th step, yes, I work with a lot of alcoholics. Many of them are in the room tonight. I love you ladies. But it's practicing the principles all out there. That's the tough part. You know, we always have to think step 12 is just about helping other alcoholics. But oh no, it's trying to be better people in all areas of our lives. And I can tell you that none of it was possible without that initial relationship with a higher power that I didn't know was there, that I didn't want to know was there because I thought I knew everything. But I'm going to read you something and let you know what I think. It's probably my two favorite paragraphs. I don't know. Ira and I, we just love all the paragraphs. We always say all our favorite paragraphs. It's on page 55. And it goes like this. For deep down in every man, woman, and child is the fundamental idea of God. It may be obscured by calamity, by pomp, by worship of other things, but in some form or other it is there. Faith in a power greater than ourselves and miraculous demonstrations of that power in human lives are facts as old as man himself. We finally saw that faith in some kind of God was a part of our makeup. Just as much as the feeling that we had for a friend. Sometimes we had to search fearlessly, but he was there. He wasn't as much a fact as we were. We found the great reality deep down within us. In the last analysis, it is only there that he may be found, and so it is with us. About 25 years ago, I had this sudden realization that my higher power had been there the entire time, and that I was blocking that sunlight of that spirit. You were blocking the sunlight of that spirit. That I could have engaged, it could have called out to it at any time and it would have been available to me. But for some reason, my ego and my pride and all those things would not allow me to do that. And so I was very happy about 25 years ago when I realized, dang, man, my higher power is just like Dorothy's ruby slippers. She had the power to go home the entire time and she did not know it. She needed to go through all the things that she went through and she needed her friends to show her how to engage that power to get home. And that is what I needed. I needed you guys to show me where the higher power is and how to engage it on an everyday basis in my life. And I thank you because you guys definitely brought me home. And I love you all.
Thank you, Julie. You guys have to do the trick.
First I slipped,
and then I crept to a hope-filled dream. You rescued me, and finally, waking there I see. I look into love's window for a soul that's meant for me. Takes me where the promises are real. Sometimes quickly, sometimes slow, we get just what we need. On a broad highway, stride for stride, we walk eternally. Look into love's window for a heart that beats for me. Takes me where the promises are real. And I always long for something that sets me free. Take me where the promises are.